have you all here. The first case of the day is 09. I'm always telling everyone to stand in front of the mic. Okay. Is 09-4080 Kingstead versus the State Bar of Wisconsin. Good morning, Mr. Levine.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Levine. I'm an attorney from Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm here today representing the appellants on this appeal. The appellants are also referred to in the brief as objectors. The issue in this case is whether this court's 1996 decision in Teal versus State Bar of Wisconsin has been superseded by the United States Supreme Court decision in United States versus United Foods.
Could I just ask you a real quick question? Is there an issue or claim preclusion problem here, at least as to Mr. Thiel, who, of course, litigated and lost on the germaneness question in Thiel?
I don't think there is, Your Honors, because whatever decision this court makes would be applicable equally to all three complainants in this case. In other words, if the court decides that Thiel has been overruled, then there wouldn't be, obviously, a claim preclusion case as to any of the parties. Okay. I hope that answers your question. The appellant's argument in this case is based on three points made by the United States Supreme Court in the United Foods case. First, the Supreme Court said that speech need not be considered political before it receives First Amendment protection. And the court was referring specifically to the speech in United Foods, which was non-political advertising, which is the same type of advertising which is at issue in the case before the court today. So the Supreme Court said speech need not be considered political before it receives First Amendment protection. Second, the court went on specifically to discuss its previous decision in the Keller case, and it summarized and set forth two specific points as to a lawyer's obligation under Keller. First, as far as the obligation went, it said that lawyers could be required to pay money in support of activities that were germane to the reason justifying the compelled association in the first place. And in the case of an integrated bar, those activities are regulating the legal profession and improving the quality of legal services.
How much weight are you putting on United Foods?
Substantial amount of weight.
You know, it's really difficult. United Foods dealt not with an integrated bar, but with a mushroom council. And it's good to know our mushrooms have a council. And although the court invalidated the use of compelled dues by council members to pay for generic mushroom advertising, the court's rationale seems to be that the council had little purpose in practice other than to sponsor such advertisements. So the advertisements were not ancillary to some more comprehensive program that would justify forcing mushroom producers to associate with the council. And, of course, the court didn't address whether, when there is such a comprehensive program like we have here, that all expenditures supported by compelled dues must be germane to the purposes of that program, even if they are non-ideological.
But yes, it did, Your Honor, if I could amplify on that. The court went on, it placed the mushroom advertising in the context of Abood. It discussed the Abood case. It discussed the Keller case. It said that all of these cases fit into the situation where you have a compulsory membership group and it specifically discussed what a lawyer's obligation was to an integrated bar under its Keller decision. It went on to state, first of all, that a lawyer could be required to pay money to support activities which were germane to the reason justifying the compelled association in the first place. So it specifically discussed what the obligations of a lawyer were in the integrated bar situation.
Mr. Levine, can I ask you a question about some of these cases? If I understand Thiel correctly, it held that all of the activities in dispute were actually germane to the purposes of the integrated bar, correct?
I believe it did go on to say that, yes.
I mean, there's some, we can debate what's a holding and what's dicta, but it is correct that the case treated as germane all of the expenditures that were at issue, correct?
I believe it did, yes.
And we know that the same is true in both as well in the Gardner against Nevada Bar case, correct? You might disagree with whether that was the correct holding, but here we're in this kind of abstract discussion about whether non-germane, non-ideological expenditures are permissible. Are there any cases in which the Supreme Court has actually upheld requirements for non-germane, non-ideological speech in compulsory membership groups?
Not that I can think of, Your Honor.
And we know that in Hudson, the court dodged that issue. Okay.
In Hudson, the Supreme Court didn't take up this issue. But when the Hudson case was at the circuit court level,
right,
this court, writing through Judge Posner, mm-hmm, stated that the union should not be able to spend any of the compulsory dues it collected for any purposes outside the compelling state interest that justified the membership.
Right, and then we can debate about social activities and the like. But let me ask you, and I'd like to ask your opposing counsel to address the same issue. Do you read Thiel as holding that the bar can use dues for absolutely any non-germane activity it wants to?
Yes, I think that's what it says.
Such as, for example, a mandatory life insurance program, as in Romero?
As in Romero, it could do. As in,
I mean, that wasn't actually the question, obviously, in front of Thiel, but that's how you read it.
Yes, because in Thiel, the court, I think, first addressed the question of whether a non-germane, non-political activity was subject to First Amendment scrutiny, and it said no. Then it went on to say, and by the way, we think these activities are fine and germane anyway. But it covered both of those issues, and I think both of the issues were alternative grounds for the decision.
Let me ask you a sort of a sister question. If and when a court considers whether a particular activity is germane to the purposes of an integrated bar, can the court consider whatever the bar itself has identified as its purposes, or is it confined to only those purposes which are necessarily shared by all integrated bars, or to those which the Supreme Court has recognized? In other words, could an integrated bar state as one of its purposes a business development? And would that would that justify the use of compelled dues to pay for public image advertising?
No. Compelled dues can only be used for the two purposes set forth by the United States Supreme Court. Other purposes may be in the charter of a state bar, and the state bar can do those, but it cannot use compelled dues to perform those purposes. If I could continue, I think some of this could be cleared up by the third point that the United States Supreme Court made in the United Foods case, because it went on specifically to state what a lawyer's obligation was not as a member of an integrated bar. And the court went on to say the central holding of Keller, not a holding, not a statement, but the central holding of Keller, was that objecting members were not required to give speech subsidies for matters not germane to the larger regulatory purpose governing the required association.
I'm going to give you some extra time because this is it's really important. If we thought it necessary or appropriate to consider whether the Wisconsin Bar's advertising is germane to its purposes, why couldn't we reach that issue ourselves, given that the issue was presented to both the arbitrator and to the district court, but neither of them chose to address it? In other words, why is the issue so factual that we can't ourselves assess the relationship, you know, between the purposes of the state bar and the advertising program? The arbitrator did not conduct an evidentiary hearing. It was submitted on the paper. So why aren't we in as good a position as the arbitrator was to decide this?
Well, because, first of all, the specific record that was before the arbitrator.
I know, it's not before us. But, I mean, could it be supplemented? I mean, could we get it?
No, because this is an arbitration review case. It's not a case where there was a trial in the district court. The purpose of an arbitration review case is to see whether the arbitrator has made an error. And if the arbitrator has made an error, then to refer that back to the arbitrator to make a decision under the correct constitutional criteria. But in reviewing an arbitrator's decision, the court itself is not to make the decision for the arbitrator, but to decide whether the arbitrator erred, and if so, to remand it back for a decision by the arbitrator.
But without the evidentiary record that was before the arbitrator, you're making our life very difficult, aren't you?
There's only a legal issue that's involved here. That issue is whether, if an expenditure by an integrated state bar is not political or ideological, whether it's exempt from First Amendment scrutiny. The issue before the court is not whether the bar's advertising campaign was germane to the two interests the Supreme Court has said a bar can do. The question is the legal question of whether the arbitrator was exempt from scrutinizing that under the First Amendment because it wasn't political.
Well, I realize that that's everyone's position, but I'm not sure it's mine.
We may not be willing to take it quite the way it's framed.
Right.
Could I ask you a couple of questions about stemming from this arbitration procedure, which is, I have to say, from my perspective, this is a very odd procedural posture in which to see these issues presented. First of all, you're asking us if we agree with you on the constitutional abstract question to remand this to the district court to decide whether to remand to the arbitrator? Is that right?
Yes.
In his discretion?
Well, the state law gives the arbitrator discretion. There are two steps here. First of all, in reviewing an arbitration, the court decides, did the arbitrator exceed his powers? If he did exceed his powers, then there's section 788.10 paren 2, which says that the court has the discretion to remand to the arbitrator under the circumstances of that section.
If there's still time.
Right.
Okay. Why isn't it, if we agree with you, why wouldn't the appropriate remedy be to return the case to the district court for a trial, a decision on the constitutional merits? Isn't that what, I'm trying to remember the, it was the case cited by the state bar, where the time has run out, it's the Richco Structures against Parkside Village case.
Right. The trial court, the district court, decided the legal issue that was involved in this case. It agreed with the Teal case and said that the state bar's advertising was exempt from First Amendment scrutiny.
Right. But
So if it had gone the opposite way and it said, no, this should be subject to First Amendment scrutiny, the purpose of the district court was not itself to make the decision. It was to return it to the arbitrator under Section 788.10, paren 2 of the statutes. Again,
But the bar is saying the time has run out for that, and Richco tells us in that situation, just go back and litigate it, doesn't it?
Right, but we're saying the time did not run out at all. There was no time limit for the arbitrator's decision in this case.
Well, let me ask about the arbitration, if I could, in a different way, Mr. Levine. Do we owe the arbitrator's decision any deference at all on the legal issue that was presented?
Not on the constitutional issue.
And why not?
Under state law, under state arbitration law, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has said that an arbitrator exceeds his powers if his decision is unconstitutional, if it conflicts or contradicts a constitutional provision or case law interpreting a constitutional provision, which is exactly what we're arguing. We're arguing that the arbitrator's decision, he said, I don't have to look at this expense to see if it's germane because it's not political or ideological. Our argument is that that's in conflict with the First Amendment and with the United Foods case. Therefore, under state arbitration law, which is the law that's applicable here, Wisconsin Supreme Court has said that if the arbitrator's decision is unconstitutional, it's in excess of his authority, and it must be remanded to him for a decision under proper constitutional requirements.
Why did you file this? Why did you seek arbitration instead of just going to district court?
We just thought that arbitration would be much easier and much quicker than going to the district court. Their strategy, I suppose, Civil Rights Action could have been brought in the district court right away, too. It's an alternative procedure. But we just thought it would be easier and faster through arbitration.
Okay.
Obviously, things don't always turn out the way one predicts.
All of us have experience like that, Mr. Levine. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Marshall, would you be kind enough to give Ms. Howell extra time? And you will still have your rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
And we will leave here at 4 in the afternoon. Hi, Ms. Howell. Or hello, Ms. Howell.
Grabbed the wrong binder.
Very nice if you'd raise it back up.
Just slightly would be great. I'm short, but I'm not quite that short. That's great. Thank you very much.
See, next time you can do it yourself.
Thank you. There it is. I didn't see the button when it was down lower, but thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Roberta Howell, and I am from Foley & Lardner, representing the State Bar of Wisconsin. Excuse me. With me in the courtroom today are George Brown, the executive director, and Diane Deal, the immediate past president of the State Bar as well.
Lovely to have all of you, and all the rest of you, too.
Thank you. This case is the most recent iteration of what Judge Bauer described the last time these very parties were here on this very same issue as the seemingly never-ending battle between Wisconsin attorneys and the Wisconsin State Bar.
Why is the bar integrated?
Why is the bar integrated? Mm-hmm. Because the Wisconsin Supreme Court found that there are a number of purposes that an integrated bar serves that are good for the people of the state of Wisconsin and for the lawyers of the state of Wisconsin and for the judicial system of the state of Wisconsin, and that those purposes were best served by an integrated bar. The bar in Wisconsin was not integrated for some period of time recently. As this court may recall, in the late 1980s, Mr. Levine brought a challenge to the constitutionality of the integrated bar in Wisconsin in Levine versus Heffernan. And the district court in that decision adopted his analysis and found that it was, in fact, unconstitutional to require lawyers to be members of a state bar. Subsequent to that decision, and while that decision was on appeal to this court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court suspended the mandatory bar rule in Wisconsin, and the State Bar of Wisconsin, in fact, acted as a voluntary bar. After the U.S. Supreme Court decided in Keller that a mandatory bar was, in fact, constitutional and reiterated its holding in the Lathrop versus Donahue case, a 1960 decision challenging the integrated bar in Wisconsin, the bar was reintegrated, and the rule that's at issue here was adopted. Originally adopted in a slightly different form, following the first arbitration in which the arbitrator accepted the objector's argument that all activities of the bar needed to be germane in order to be chargeable with mandatory dues, the court revised its decision and adopted the rule as it currently stands today, under which there's a several-step analysis that the bar must go through each year.
If there's no requirement, you took a breath. That's a mistake. If there's no requirement that an integrated bar restrict the use of compelled dues to activities that are germane to the purposes of the bar, then and could the Wisconsin Bar compel its members? This came up in the last argument, of course, to purchase insurance from it, as the Puerto Rican Bar did in Moreno. In other words, what limit, if any, would there be on the activities that a state bar could compel its members to fund?
Well, I believe there's two limits, if you will. The first, in fact, are the limits of the bar, the purposes of the bar that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has established. It has certain activities that it can engage in under the rules of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I believe it's Rule 10.01. That limits the activities of the bar generally to specific activities that the court has identified are appropriate.
But aren't many of those sort of amorphous?
I believe they are somewhat amorphous, Your Honor, but in fact when it comes to applying them to particular activities, it's often not a very difficult process to determine.
Really? They're also matters of state law. And I understood the argument here to be that there is as to what the constitutional limits are.
And that was my next point, Your Honor, and that is that from a constitutional standpoint, from a First Amendment standpoint, which is the issue here, if the activity is not political or ideological, this Court's decision in Thiel and the United States Supreme Court's decisions do not limit. There's a question of propriety. There's a question of dealing with your members, there is a question of dealing with the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but not from a constitutional standpoint.
So is it your position that the First Circuit was wrong in the Romero case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if the bar wanted to fund a literacy campaign or make contributions to research on a particular disease, you'd be perfectly entitled to, as a matter of federal constitutional law, to use mandatory dues for those purposes?
I'm not sure that's quite correct, because I think that some of the activities that you're talking about tend to get, as the Supreme Court recognized in Keller, there's a continuum, and where the line is on that continuum is not always easy to determine. And the question is whether those would be political or ideological.
Literacy?
I don't know whether some of those, depending on the circumstances, they may or may not be political or ideological, and then they would
Let's assume we find a literacy campaign or required insurance purchases would be non-ideological and non-political.
Okay.
Are they permissible?
Under the First Amendment, yes. Under the Wisconsin Supreme Court's rules, I'm not so sure.
Well, what trumps what here?
Well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court's rules are the first limits on the bar's activities. If it can't engage in them in the first place, then we don't even get to the constitutional question. It's only if they're permissible under the Supreme Court's rules that we get to the constitutional question.
No, but as you can see, parties differ on this. So these are wonderful responses, but looking down the road, there's the difficulty. The United Food decision did seem to understand Keller as holding that an integrated bar may only use compelled dues to fund those activities which are germane to its purposes. Now, I grant you that Keller itself was not so clear on that point, but how can we ignore the court's subsequent characterization of Keller's holding?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at the rest of the decision. There is other language in the decision that I think sheds light on that comment. There's no question that the bar can use compelled dues to engage in germane activities. The real question is, at what point are there certain activities that the bar cannot engage in using compelled dues? And the language in United Foods that I think is crucial and which is ignored by the objectors is the sentence right after the one that they repeat in their brief over and over. And that sentence is at 413 of the decision. Quote, before addressing whether a conflict with freedom of belief exists, A threshold inquiry must be made whether there is some state-imposed obligation which makes group membership less than voluntary, end quote, and then the question becomes whether that obligation is constitutional. This goes to the first question you asked earlier in the argument, which was, isn't the real issue in United Foods that there was no overriding basis for the compelled association in the first instance? What this quote from United Foods makes clear is that the court didn't eliminate the question of whether activities are political or ideological. What it made clear was that there's first a threshold inquiry, and that threshold inquiry is whether the compelled association itself is constitutional. Only if you get past that inquiry do you get to the political and ideological.
Is there any doubt, though, about that? What you're saying, the threshold inquiry, it's an integrated mandatory bar.
And that's correct. And so
what's in dispute here?
The difference is, in United Foods, that didn't exist. And so, therefore, the court really never got into the question of germaneness and political or ideological. You need to step back and take a look at the Glickman decision, which leads into United Foods.
Well, could I ask you just to address a question that I raised with Mr. Levine? Can you direct me to any cases from the Supreme Court holding that a non-germane expenditure is permissible when you've got a compelled group membership?
Yes, that's the Ellis versus Steamship Railway Clerk's decision, Your Honor.
That's the social dues. The expenses of the union social.
Yes.
Okay. Is that the best you can do?
That's the one I'm thinking of off the top of my head, yes, Your Honor. And I believe there are several cases that cite, for example, the Thiel decision itself citing Ellis. That's not a United States Supreme Court decision, but it is a case relying on Ellis in this court that
but,
found
but Thiel found that every single expenditure in question was germane, correct?
Yeah. Of the eight or nine that were at issue, yes, that's correct.
So that really doesn't tell us how to handle non-germane.
Well, no, because before it ever got to that issue, the Thiel decision made a point of saying these activities were permissible because if it was not ideological and not political, there's no First Amendment issue. That was the first holding in Thiel, and then it went on to say, and by the way, we've asked what activities were of concern, and we find that all of them are germane.
Can I ask you a question? Why did the state bar remove this case to federal court? Why not litigate it in the state courts where it would go back to the Supreme Court that wrote this rule?
Several reasons, Your Honor. One of which is that things move much more quickly in the federal courts than they do in the state courts. Two is that the controlling authority is from this court, and from the controlling constitutional authority is from this court and from the federal courts in this district.
Do you think that we owe the arbitrator any deference on the constitutional issue?
The arbitrator did not decide the constitutional question.
Okay. So we should decide it de novo.
That's correct.
Okay.
The arbitrator did, however, decide that the activities were not political or ideological, and that's undisputed on appeal. And to your question earlier about can we decide whether these are germane, with respect, I believe that essentially, if not every piece of the record that was before the arbitrator is before this court, nearly all of it is, because, in fact, the issues, the record that was before the arbitrator were written materials that are available online and are published materials. It was all paper that was the record that the arbitrator decided on, and those materials are available to this court. And I believe
what by searching through computers,
their sites are actually most of them are actually in the state bar's brief.
But I mean, wouldn't we at least need the evidentiary record that was before the arbitrator?
The evidentiary record was the written materials that are available online and are cited in the state bar's brief.
I know, but don't you normally give it to us so that, you know, one of us doesn't spend weeks and weeks and weeks rooting around for it?
But you mean maybe computer illiterate, and I plead guilty.
The materials can be provided easily, Your Honor. They are published materials, just like published, and many of them are published decisions, for that matter, published decisions of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and of this court. So they are largely available, but they can be provided easily.
So, in other words, if we asked you to supplement our record here, you could do that.
Yes. Returning to the Glickman case, as I was mentioning earlier.
Supplement the record. I think we need, you know, we may not use it, but I think we need it. We need to know everything.
Certainly. Do you have a specific date by which you'd like that?
Tomorrow.
Okay.
No.
Could be done. It's really that simple.
10 days.
Okay. Returning to Glickman, I think that Glickman sheds a lot of light on the United Foods decision, and it can't be forgotten. Glickman was another agricultural assessment, mandatory assessment case. In Glickman, the court upheld the mandatory assessment, unlike the case in United Foods. And in that case, it did so for two reasons. First, it did so because there was a justification for the compelled association in the first instance, the piece that was lacking in United Foods. And second, and importantly, it did so because there was no political or ideological aspect to the advertising. In fact, at one point, page 475 of the decision, the Glickman court quotes Keller and finds that the test in Keller for the ability to use mandatory charges to fund activities was met because, quote, in any event, the assessments are not used to fund ideological activities, end quote. Also at page 469, it distinguishes Keller and the discussion in Keller where certain activities were clearly ideological and political and were not germane. And it distinguishes that situation from that which was before it, finding that the regulatory scheme at issue in Glickman did, quote, not compel the producers to endorse or finance any political or ideological activities. Now, United Foods did not overrule Glickman. United Foods was careful to refer to Glickman as precedent and to distinguish the situation in United Foods from Glickman. And so Glickman is still good law and is still appropriate for review here. Importantly, Glickman also refers to the Abood case at 471.
Was there any issue of germaneness in Glickman?
In Glickman, no, because the issues were not political
or
ideological.
So how does it help us? It's undisputed here that these expenditures are non-ideological.
That's not disputed on appeal. That's correct.
What is disputed is germaneness.
Right. Actually, I'm not even sure that they're raising that issue at this point because they want to take that back to the district court, but that would be the issue if it went back, yes.
Right.
Okay. In Glickman at page 471, the court notes, quote, Abood and the cases that follow it did not announce a broad First Amendment right not to be compelled to provide financial support for any organization that conducts expressive activities. Rather, Abood merely recognized a First Amendment interest in not being compelled to contribute to an organization whose expressive activities conflict with one's, quote, freedom of belief. That's the issue. The political and ideological activities are what Abood recognize an interest in not being compelled to support.
Ms. Howell, let me ask you a question. We're here talking not only about freedom of expression and belief, but also about freedom of association.
Correct.
Right? And let me back up, I guess, a little bit. Why would the courts interpreting the First Amendment want to allow mandatory membership groups to require financial support for non-germane activities?
I think that issue was addressed in Ellis to some extent, in which the court mentioned the fact that an organization, as an organization, has certain activities it needs to engage in. There are certain activities that are clearly permissible and certain activities that are clearly not permissible. Okay, those are the two ends of the spectrum that are easy, that Keller identified. In the middle, those questions are difficult. The court allows a certain amount of leeway to those.
I'm not troubled by the idea that there's a certain amount of leeway in the concept of germaneness, as Judge Ripple suggested in his separate opinion in Thiel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not troubled by that. But you seem to be telling us that the only question we need to ask is whether the activity is political or ideological. And once we've answered that question, we're done. So let's go back to the Romero case and the mandatory life insurance policy.
Okay.
Why would the courts want to allow a mandatory membership group like a bar to require people to do that if it's not germane to the purposes of the group, the purposes that justify the forced association?
Because the issue doesn't implicate any First Amendment rights.
It implicates the right of association.
But the right of association, but it doesn't implicate any rights of association beyond those that are already there. The question in Ellis is, does the activity that's at issue create an additional impingement on the First Amendment rights that's already inherent in the compelled association itself? That's why in Ellis, for example, the social activities were not considered to be...
So, in Romero, you've got a bar that's using nearly three-quarters of its dues, mm-hmm. mandatory dues, to buy life insurance that some members didn't want to pay for through that group. That's permissible as a matter of constitutional law as you see it, correct?
It's not an issue of constitutional laws, is the point that I'm trying to make, is that it doesn't...
Circuit thought it was.
Under Keller, I understand that, but under Keller and the other decisions, if it's not political or ideological, it is not an issue of First Amendment
law. Okay, so if it's non-germane, it's okay. Literacy programs, insurance purchasing requirements, Be Kind to Your Children Day.
That's what the cases say, Your Honor. And that's what this court's decision in Thiel says, is that non-germane, non-ideological activities do not raise additional First Amendment concerns.
Under there, because some of them bring people with guns.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Your Honors. On rebuttal, I'd like to address three points that Ms. Howell addressed, and also something that a couple of you addressed on my original argument. And that is, I want to very strongly argue that this court does not have the jurisdiction to make the decision in the first instance as to whether the State Bar's public image advertising campaign was germane or not. It was earlier asked why we went to arbitration rather than going to the district court under a civil rights action. And arbitration has certain advantages for the plaintiffs. In this specific case, the arbitrator, although saying that he did not have to find whether the State Bar expenditure for this advertising was germane, said that if he were deciding, he would have decided it against the State Bar. The footnote 5 in our reply brief quotes the arbitrator in his decision. He said, "I believe that based on the evidence presented, it is a stretch to regard improving the quality of legal services as the campaign's primary purpose. There is simply too much in the record indicating that the predominant goals have more to do with the interest of lawyers than the interest of their clients or potential clients." So, again, this is an arbitration review case, not a case where this court or the district court was to decide whether the expenditure was germane. It was to decide whether the arbitrator committed error by holding that he did not have to apply the germaneness test because this expense wasn't political. That's the issue before the court, not whether the expense was germane to regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. The State Bar makes the argument, trying to distinguish the United Foods case from this case, by saying that in United Foods, when the Supreme Court said that speech need not be political in order to have First Amendment protection, that only applied in the situation where there was no compelling state interest for the organization, where 100% of the funds at issue were alleged to be non-germane. But it says in the case of a state bar where perhaps 50% or 25 or 10% of the bar dues are alleged to be used for a non-germane purpose, then an entirely different test applies. In one case, where it's 100%, the speech need not be political. But if it's less than 100%, all of a sudden the test totally changes and the speech must be political in order to be protected by the First Amendment. We think that that's not only contrary to what the Supreme Court said in the United Foods case, but it also doesn't make any sense. There's no logical justification for applying one First Amendment test in one case and one in another case. Finally, I would just like to point out that the State Bar relies rather heavily on the Glickman case and says the Glickman case is still valid. Yet in the United Foods case, the Supreme Court specifically said it addressed Glickman and it said, we take further notice in Abood that speech need not be political. So it mentioned Glickman and it said, no, we're going to be following this part of Abood that says speech does not need to be political in order to merit First Amendment protection. In closing, again, I would just like to say that this case is governed by the arbitration review law of Chapter 788 of the Wisconsin statutes. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin has interpreted Section 788.10, paren 1D, to say that when an arbitrator acts unconstitutionally, he acts in excess of his powers.
You're relying there on the Racine County case?
Yes.
Okay.
And because the arbitrator in this case decided he did not have to apply the germaneness test to this expense, he acted, where our argument is that he acted unconstitutionally and therefore in excess of his powers.
Well, thank you so much to both parties. And the case, of course, will be taken under advisement.
Well, you've been very kind, Your Honors.